Welcome back to the third hour of Issues Etc. Greg Kokel is going to join us here to talk about two things. You may have seen both of these in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. One is an editorial, recent editorial called Eggs and Ethics. It's pointing out, well, it's attempting to point out what it perceives to be the reality surrounding embryonic stem cell research and human cloning. And the other is from Ellen Goodman under the heading, Who Decides? She Says Choice is Also the Right Not to Have an Abortion. Now, at first I read that and I thought to myself, well, Ellen Goodman seems to be getting some sense in her head. And then I read on and I got a little confused, especially the example she uses to say that pro-choicers are really about women deciding even if they don't want to have an abortion. She uses is it a club against parental notification, any kind of parental involvement in the abortion of minors. So she lost me. Greg Kokel joins us to talk about this, and then in 25 minutes, audio open lines for your questions and comments. Greg is president of Stand to Reason based in Signal Hill, California, and he's co-author of the book Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Mid-Air. Greg, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks, Todd. It's good to talk to you again.
Let's talk about this Ellen Goodman column first. Do you buy her take on what it means to be pro-choice? It's the right for a woman not to have an abortion. And she says that's what it's really always been about in the pro-choice movement.
Well, actually, that seems to be her thrust here, at least initially. I think I'm not surprised you're confused because it is a little bit of a convoluted argument that she offers here. But if what she means by pro-choice is that a woman should have the choice not to have an abortion, of course, I agree with that. I agree that a woman should have the choice not to have an abortion. But that's not what she's really arguing here. That's her bait, as it were, to draw you into the piece. And she is basically trying to, well, she takes a circumstance, this case, Caitlin Kampf, who's 19 years old and whose parents kidnapped her, you know, tied her hands, taped her mouth, and tried to drag her to another state to force her to have an abortion. Because she was pregnant with a child from an African-American man who was in jail. So her parents were really upset. And the daughter, was able to escape. And this is, of course, the emotional, as I said, carrot that's kind of being offered here. And I think anybody of common sense is going to say, yeah, Caitlin Kampf should not have been abducted for this purpose. But she uses that as a lever to explain to argue the flaws of parental consent laws, and she takes parental consent laws to be that the choice is no longer with the minor, the choice is with the parents, and the choice should be with the minor, is what she believes, being pro-choice, whether to have an abortion or not to have an abortion. And when you shift the choice to the parents, then the parents could choose to force her to have an abortion against her will, and that's what you're stuck with, pro-lifers, if you really believe in parental consent laws. But Goodman's argument it fails because she's mischaracterized the nature of parental consent laws. Parental consent laws do not shift the choice from the child to the parent, such that the parent can choose anything they want in principle. Parental consent laws are not parental choice laws; they're parental consent laws. That is, the state is saying there are certain medical decisions that it's appropriate that the parents give consent to if the minor child wants to have them. They don't say that under all circumstances, the parents get to choose whatever they want for the child.
Okay, let's stop there for a second. So, if I'm following you, and now I'm less confused, thank you. If I'm following you correctly, let's just say instead of abortion, we're talking about a tattoo. All right, so if my daughter wants to go get a tattoo, God forbid, she might, because she's only 15, she have to get my permission to do it. I'd have to sign a paper
right, so
the guy can ink her up, whatever was going
right.
on.
Because right. Because there might be some medical risks involved, and you need to be apprised of the concerns. And she may not be making a proper judgment where her medical health is concerned, and a parent should be involved in the process.
All right. Yes. But Ellen Goodman's logic seems to go this way. Just because I have to sign off on her desire to have a tattoo, if that law that requires me to sign off on her desire also empowers me somehow to force her to get tattooed as much as I want.
Yeah, I think that's the way she's trying to argue. Obviously, when you put it that way, which you're taking now the spin off of her argument, her argument is obviously false. But that's what needs that's what she's depending on. I mean, that line of reasoning is what makes her point go forward. And if her point goes forward in that way, and it has this other logical bizarre consequence that, well, if that's true, then no parental consent laws should be in force, because if consent means the parents get to make all the choices, then by golly, parents might just truck their child off to have both arms amputated without her consent, and you never know what parents are going to do. They get a little silly. So her argument proves too much. If you argue against parental consent laws on this basis for abortion, then you must argue for the same reasons against all parental consent laws with regards to medical treatments of minors. And, of course, the mistake she's making is she's confusing consent with choice. And there's a difference, of course. The heart of Goodman's misunderstanding here is that she takes the requirement for consent in a limited way to be the liberty of coercion in an unlimited way. I mean, the reason, as I mentioned, they're called parental consent laws is because they require parental consent on some matters. They don't legitimize parental coercion on any matter. I mean, it seems to me that there are some choices a minor shouldn't be allowed to make without her parents' approval, and that doesn't mean that parents can then coerce the child to do anything they want. And if that follows, then Goodman's simply mistaken. The moral logic of parental consent laws does not lead to abductions and forced abortions.
Okay, with that dealt with, then respond to this line from Ellen Goodman, which I think is probably the line she wants her readers to take away. She writes, "A forced abortion is as much an assault on liberty as a forced pregnancy." What does she mean there, and how would you respond to it?
Well, this is a way of characterizing the pro-life position, so it looks really bad, all right? You're forcing someone to be a parent, is the general way this is characterized, but here she's using the word pregnancy rather than parenthood. The flaw in this is that nobody is forcing anybody to get pregnant or to become a parent. The question here is whether or not the young lady, Caitlin, was pregnant already. And if she is pregnant already and the unborn is a human being, then she already is a parent. It's just that her child hasn't been introduced formally to her or to the rest of the world because the child is still developing inside mom. But if that is a real human being, then she already is a parent, and nobody is forcing her to become a parent. They're forcing her to be a good parent. But the law already does that. You can't abuse your child. You have to take care of your child. You can't say to your two-year-old, gee, you know, I never planned this pregnancy. I have a right to do what I want with my own body, so I am taking my body to Florida while my two-year-old stays in my apartment in New York City. I put some food on the floor there for her to eat. I'm sure she'll get through fine for the next couple of weeks, but, you know, I have my liberty. Now, of course, the law wouldn't countenance such a thing. Indeed, that very thing happened a number of years ago, and the parents were prosecuted for child abuse because once you have a child, your personal liberties are much restricted by your moral obligations. And by the same token, if pregnancy is the condition in which a mother already has a child, then all this kind of law forces her to do is to treat the child properly instead of taking the child's life.
Isn't that really the difference here between pro-choice and pro-life? And that is, it's just a disagreement about when parental obligations and the attendant curtailing of one's own, exercise of one's own rights, when those kick in.
Well, that's true. I think that's an incidental point, though. I mean, it's true as far as it goes, but it's incidental because that point has to be answered by a deeper concern, and that deeper concern is captured with only one question. And we've been over this before, Todd, because this is the theme that Stand to Reason presses all the time in the abortion issue to simplify the issue, and that is, what is the unborn? And the way I put it is, if the unborn, whatever that is that's growing in there, we know it's alive. People say, well, nobody knows when life begins. Listen, if it's growing, it's alive. I mean, that's simple. It's a living thing in there. Now, what is it? If the unborn is not a valuable human being, then no justification for abortion is necessary. We don't need to have this discussion. Go ahead, have the abortion. However, if the unborn is, in fact, a human being, then none of the standard justifications for abortion are adequate. And for the reason that we don't take the life of innocent human beings for the reasons that people usually give for having an abortion. And so my analysis here depends upon the fact that the unborn is a human being, and that's why I say this isn't a forced pregnancy. It isn't forced parenthood that is causing someone to become pregnant or causing them to become a parent. If my view of the status of the unborn is correct, that the unborn is a human being at every level of development, and human beings are valuable in themselves, then they already are pregnant and they already are parents. And when that's the case, if you already are a parent, a different set of rules apply. So I think the fundamental question might be phrased, is she already a parent or not? And that, of course, is determined by the answer to the question, what is the unborn?
So that goes nicely with my predecessor here at Issues, Etc., Don Matzett, often said that he says, I'm preconceptually pro-choice.
Yeah.
Choice up to the time of conception.
Or Scott Klusendorf puts it this way. He says, I'm pro-abortion as long as abortion doesn't kill a valuable human being.
Show me an example where it doesn't.
Yeah, what that does is I think that simplifies what people say is a complicated issue, Todd. I don't think it's that morally complicated. I think you have to answer some basic questions. What is the unborn, first of all? And then once you determine what it is, and that's really a scientific question, then you have to ask the question, what moral obligations do we have to creatures like that? In this case, human beings who are innocent and can't defenseless, but are in the way in some fashion. Need we, ought we protect them from others who want to get them out of the way? And now that's a philosophical question because it deals with what's right and what's wrong, and ethics, morality is a philosophical issue. But I think we already have a leg up on answering that question because we already have laws about how we ought to treat other human beings. The irony, Todd, is we already have laws about how we ought to treat unborn human beings. In two-thirds of the states in this union, including the liberal state of California, there are actually fetal homicide laws. That is, if you kill a fetus, then you kill a valuable human being and you're guilty of homicide. Indeed, there was just a brutal murder recently, and I don't know if it was in California or where. I just caught a line or two at a
right here in the Midwest.
It was in the Midwest, where a baby was actually carved out of the abdomen of a mother.
Happened right here near St. Louis. Yes.
Okay. Well, see, now what is that? The person who is being accused of the crime, perpetrator? What is she being charged with? She's being charged with double homicide, one for mom and one for the baby. Now, why is it that the law treats that unborn child as a valuable human being when if that woman was, the killer was a doctor and the mother said it was okay, she could have done exactly the same thing with regards to the unborn child. And it would have been a constitutionally protected right. Now, of course, people say, well, because there's consent in one case and there's not consent in the other. But look at what consent is meant to be doing here. The mere feature or factor of consent changes a valuable human being who, if you take their life, you are guilty of a capital crime, to something that is just a discarded piece of tissue that you have a right to destroy. How does consent change the nature of what that baby is? That's what's ridiculous about the law.
One other thing on this. Isn't it kind of ironic, and maybe I'm, again, not fully understanding Ellen Goodman's commentary here, but it seems to me that she is actually the one who is advocating for unrestricted parental exercise of choice over one's child by saying a mother can abort her child. She is the one, she seems to be arguing against parental, this kind of overblown parental consent where parents can do as they please with their offspring. She is actually arguing for that.
Yeah, well,
if the parent is the mother who has the abortion.
Right. No, that's a very clever insight, Todd, and I had never thought of that. Very clever. Good for you. Kudos to you on that one. Maybe I'll steal it someday.
Hey, feel free to steal it. I would be honored for you to steal it.
Basically, what you're saying is that, well, there's actually two kinds of cases of parental consent here. On the one hand, she's arguing tongue-in-cheek, in a sense that, well, that your parental consent laws actually support our view, because here's a bizarre thing that you would not be in favor of, the parents making the choice for the abortion, and that really supports our view of pro-choice. But what is her view of pro-choice? That in their case of abortion, the parent gets to make the call of whether the child lives or dies. And that is the ultimate and the most extreme kind of parental consent that is, of course, built into her pro-choice view. Of course, that depends on the fact that the unborn is a human being, in the sense that we're talking about, and that may be, that's where the, and that actually is where the whole discussion turns.
Okay, one other thought here on Ellen Goodman. I just want your general idea very briefly on.
By the way, Todd, you should blog on that. That was a clever point.
I don't have a blog, but
okay.
You go ahead and blog on it. Just give me some credit, and then it's yours
all
from
right,
then
all
on.
Right.
No charge. Okay. What is your general thought on the whenever parental consent comes up, and it's again an issue here in the neighboring state of Illinois. Whenever it comes up, there's always these worst case scenarios marched out to say, you know, there are parents out there who kids can't go to. They can't go to their parents and tell them they're pregnant. Now, I'm certain there are parents like that, but those, I don't think anyone's arguing that's the rule rather than the exception.
Well, you always build law on what you just referred to as the rule. What is the common state of affairs? And so there's a principle in place here, and it's a sound principle. Principle being that minors getting medical care should not do so without the consent of their proper guardian. I mean, this is not controversial. And so if someone can spin, and this is why I said that Goodman's argument proves too much, if someone wants to spin these worst-case scenario illustrations when the issue comes to abortion, and that is an argument against parental consent on abortion, why wouldn't the same way of arguing apply towards any other medical concern, having an aspirin, getting a tattoo, having an operation? What if this 17-year-old wanted to have a hysterectomy? What if she said, you know what, I don't ever want to have children, and I want to have sex freely without any difficulty at all, so I want to have a hysterectomy at 17. Would Goodman say that's okay for her to do because she should have the choice to do that if she wants? I doubt Goodman would do that. But because she believes in the general concept of parental consent, it's just that she abandons her principles here when it comes to abortion, and she is trying to argue that pro-lifers are abandoning their principles as well. But I'm countering with, we aren't abandoning our principles here because we don't believe parental consent is the same as parental choice. We aren't saying that parents should have the choice, no matter what. We are just simply agreeing with the wisdom of the law that when it comes to medical concerns, minors ought to have the consent of their parents in these matters. Not in everything, but in these matters. It doesn't mean that the parents can make choices and demand that the children, under most circumstances, have medical care. It just means that they ought to be brought into the picture and that they have a role in the process. This is not controversial. It should not be controversial, and therefore when that rule is applied consistently to the extreme medical circumstances of abortion, I mean, we're not talking about taking an aspirin here, and that requires parental consent for minors. We're talking about abortion, a surgical procedure, then the same principle should apply in the same way, and Christians or pro-lifers are not goofy for holding that to be the case.
The next piece I want to talk about here is this editorial from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch called Eggs and Ethics. It makes two points. I'd like you to respond to them.
Okay.
One is that this whole debate that we're having here in Missouri over Amendment 2, which would keep legal embryonic stem cell research in the state of Missouri, is not exactly jiving with reality as it is. It says, look, cloning isn't even possible, and that's where a lot of the debate has focused on when it comes to human beings. And the other point it makes is that egg donation is not going to be a problem when it comes to the, you know, exchange of cash for eggs because that's already against the law. Let's deal with the first one first.
Well, yeah, she makes another point, too, that I'll get to at the end, but or the author. I don't know who the author is, if this is an editorial piece or not. But I read it very carefully, and the way I read it, Todd, this author is not arguing that cloning isn't so much possible, but it's necessary for embryonic stem cell research to go forward. She says the process is called somatic cell nuclear transfer, SCNT. Now, this is known better by the C word, cloning, but she tries to make this, I think, illegitimate distinction between reproductive cloning and cloning for research, basically, therapeutic cloning. And to say that it's impossible is nonsense because it's already been done. That's where Dolly came from. And it's been repeated many, many times. You can get living mammals through SCNT. Now, whether that has been done yet with human beings is another question, and yes, there have been some problems with it, but I don't see any reason why that can't go forward in the future. which then raises the question, where are you going to get all the eggs to do this, and raises the question of, well, maybe women will be exploited for the taking of their eggs for embryonic stem cell research through cloning using those eggs, somatic cell nuclear transfer. Actually, I'm somewhat sympathetic to this concern that was raised here. Sometimes as Christians or pro-lifers, we make knee-jerk reactions to things, and part of what she's saying is, look, people already are giving or selling, de facto selling their eggs for in vitro fertilization for parents that, you know, maybe can't have children any other way, and this hasn't gotten out of hand, and it hasn't created exploitation. So, you know, it's a little bit, crying wolf for pro-lifers to scream about this with regards to somatic cell nuclear transfer or cloning. And I think she's got a point. Sometimes we're just kind of lions and tigers and bears. Mm-hmm. Oh, my, you know. Now, the sky is falling, you know, that kind of mentality. Now, I think it's a fair question that we need to keep our eyes on whether or not either practice, in vitro fertilization or the use of human eggs for cloning, it gets out of hand and somebody's exploited. But I don't know that it's necessarily going to happen. To me, the bigger concern is not getting the eggs from women. The bigger concern is using the eggs to clone human beings and then acting like, well, this is no big deal because we're going to kill that human being we create instead of letting that human being survive to maturity. And that's the distinction between therapeutic cloning and so-called reproductive cloning. But I've pointed out in the past that all cloning is reproductive cloning, in that if you successfully clone, you are actually reproducing a human being at that initial stage of development. It's just that you don't allow that human being to survive. You kill that human being before it can move to further stages.
Now, the editorial, and we only have about a minute here, a little bit less, the editorial speculates that someday the concerns over embryonic stem cell research and its connection to cloning are going to disappear, just like many Americans' concerns about in vitro fertilization have disappeared.
Yes, that's the third point that she makes. And what does this tell us? I mean, the author offers this as, I'm thinking of Goodman now, that's why I'm saying she, but the author here offers it as somehow a kind of profound insight that tells us something about the moral nature of embryonic stem cell research. Well, people squawked about something else before in vitro fertilization, and now test tube babies are the norm, and so pretty soon this will blow away too. Well, it might die down, it might blow away, but this tells us a lot about maybe news cycles or human nature, but it tells us nothing about the morality of embryonic stem cell research. This is just a destructive move.
To find out more about our guest in this hour, Greg Kokel, just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click links, and you'll find there a direct link to Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason, issuesetc.org. Or you can call Stand to Reason. Here's their toll-free number, 1-800-2-REASON, 1-800, the number 2, R-E-A-S-O-N, and ask to receive Greg's free Solid Ground newsletter. It's worth reading every time, 1-800-2-REASON. Greg Kokel is president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California, and co-author of the book Relativism, Firmly Planted in Midair. Greg, thanks.
Thank you, Todd. Anytime.
Well, when we come back, it's audio open lines for your questions and your comments. We've got a couple things to cover. I think sometime in the next half hour, we'll get a PBS Religion and Ethics feature on the faith of Senator Kerry. This goes along with a theme we've been following here for about 10 days, and that is the religious left, if you will, coming out and talking openly about their faith. We'll see what he has to say during audio open lines after this.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Listen to the words of Martin Luther on the Lord's Prayer.
With these words, God tenderly invites us to believe that He is our true Father and that we are His true children, so that with all boldness and confidence we may ask Him as dear children ask their dear Father.
Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September is an audio CD and companion booklet called Listening to Luther. This CD contains the full teaching of Luther's Small Catechism. It covers the subjects of the Ten Commandments, the Apostles' Creed, the Lord's Prayer, baptism, confession and absolution, and the Lord's Supper. For more information about the CD called Listening to Luther, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or find the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, Listening to Luther, at our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org.
The ocean floor, it can't be old.
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the children's book, D is for Dinosaur. Ken, is this one of those examples that contradicts the idea that our oceans are billions of years old?
Well, it certainly is. You know, I've often had people ask me questions like, what about all the dating methods that supposedly show the Earth is billions of years old? And I usually respond by saying, well, what about the 90% of methods that contradict the idea that the Earth is billions of years old? See, Mark, most people don't realize the majority of dating methods pose very serious problems for those who accept the secular dates. Consider the seafloor. According to secular scientists, the seafloor is supposed to be 3 billion years old. Now, scientists observe sediment being deposited on the ocean floor, and through various means and accounting for sediment coming in and being removed, they've actually been able to measure the net amount of sediment deposited. And using this amount and extrapolating backwards, there's only enough sediment to account for 12 million years. And that's assuming there was no sediment to start with. But Noah's flood would have added lots of sediment. In fact, this means the ocean floor could be much younger, as young as 6,000 years, just as the Bible indicates.
We have a free booklet we'd like you to read which shows that our Earth is not millions of years old and that a global catastrophe occurred about 4,400 years ago. It makes for some fascinating reading, so look for Ken Ham's booklet when you go to AnswersRadio.com.
I am Professor Rick Neufer. I serve on the faculty of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. I'm also the director of the Vicarage Program. To prepare men for the pastoral ministry who are biblically based, confessionally Lutheran, and evangelically active, and who bring the love of Christ to a hurting world, we require that each man complete a year of internship, which we call vicarage. The vicarage year is served in a congregation of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and its pastor is the vicar's supervisor and mentor. A vicar is not intended simply to be an extra staff person for the church to assist with the work of the parish, but is in fact a pastor in training, experiencing in the congregation the many aspects of the pastoral ministry. In a sense, the vicar is an apprentice to the pastor.
For more information about the Vicarage Program at Concordia Theological Seminary, visit www.ctsfw.edu.
Here's a happy AM850KFUO salute to our day sponsors on this Tuesday, September 26th, 2006, Reggie and Doris Y. Today's day sponsors have made a contribution to AM850KFUO in celebration of their 52nd wedding anniversary. Once again, we say thank you to Reggie and Doris Y. of Hoffman, Missouri, today's AM850KFUO day sponsors, and our very best wishes for a happy anniversary.
Look, I know exactly what it's like. You turn on the news after dinner, before you go to bed, and one of the top stories, of course, on a regular basis is what's going on in Africa, especially in the Sudan and the Darfur region. You're trying to sort it out. You watch, you know, 2 or 3 minutes of the news from Darfur, You shake your heads. You say, that's tragic. And then you flip the channel and watch reruns of Everybody Loves Raymond. Now, instead of flipping the channel and going and watching Raymond and his family exploits, just do this. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, and see what LCMS World Relief is doing for those who are suffering in the Sudan. Or you could actually pick up the phone, 1-888-930-4438, 1-888-930-4438. Everybody Loves Raymond can wait a few minutes. If you have TiVo, turn it on. Or just, I know you've seen it before, it's a rerun. 1-888-930-4438. Call LCMS World Relief and donate to their efforts in the Sudan or wherever else they're working in the world to bring a touch of mercy, a Christ-centered and cross-focused relief. The number again, 1-888-930-4438 to donate directly, or go to our website. You can donate there too, issuesetc.org, and you'll find the logo for LCMS World Relief right there at our homepage. It's audio open lines here in the last half hour. We didn't get through everything we were supposed to in the last audio open lines. We never do. But ahead, we've got a PBS Religion and Ethics feature on the faith of Senator John Kerry. I'm seeing a pattern emerge here, and My better sense and Jeff have been telling me, don't make more of this than it really is, but I've seen a pattern here emerge. Howard Dean, about 2 months ago, was talking about the need for the political left to reconnect with religious people in America. And then we heard more and more about this effort. There's an effort, Faithful Democrats, an online effort to recapture religious people for the political left. Bob Edgar comes out with a book, Middle Church. We interviewed him. Same theme. Same week, former President Jimmy Carter comes out with his book. Same theme. The religious left needs to reconnect with religious people. Or, I'm sorry, the political left needs to reconnect with religious people in America. Senator Danforth has his new book. Same theme. And then Senator John Kerry, who really has already answered a lot of these questions when he ran for president about the overlap or lack of overlap, as the case may be, between his faith as a Roman Catholic and the way that he has governed in the U.S. Senate. He's answered a lot of these questions. We'll see whether or not after the last 2 years he's changed any of those answers. Here's the story from PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly on the faith of Senator John Kerry.
Over the past few decades, the Catholic Church in America has seen an exodus.
All right, that was the wrong one. We'll get the right one here in just a moment. Hey, Jeff, we need the right cut, please. Don't worry, we'll get there. 505-7850-1800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. That was a good one, by the way. Good thing we didn't tease him too much with that one, because that was the one about the Hispanic women converting to Islam. We'll get to that one sooner or later. All right, here's the one from PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly on the faith of Senator John Kerry.
2 years ago, when Senator John Kerry ran for president, many religious Democrats were disappointed that he didn't speak more directly about his Catholic faith and how that faith influences his politics. This week, he made that speech.
At Pepperdine University in California, John Kerry outlined his vision of how faith can and should play a role in public life. Quoting frequently from the New Testament, he described how his Roman Catholic beliefs shaped many of his policy positions, and he suggested a moral agenda he believes many people of faith can share.
I lay out these four great challenges: fighting poverty and disease, taking care of the earth, reducing abortions, and fighting only just wars, as godly tasks on which we can transcend the culture wars and actually reach common ground.
In the speech, he also gave the most detailed and personal account to date of his own spiritual journey. He told me it's been difficult for him to talk about these things.
What I found was that if you don't explain what your foundation is and you don't share with people the fullness of how you come to whatever faith it is you have or don't have, then people fill in the gaps for you, and that's even more dangerous.
He spoke of a long time of searching after he had lost the faith of his youth. I asked him to describe the spiritual revelation that he says brought him back some years ago.
It was tangible. I mean, you could really sense a kind of input that really surprised me. I mean, I don't know where it came from. People can describe how those things come, but it really changed how I was thinking about myself and God and my relationship to the church, and answers came that hadn't been there previously.
He now describes his faith as very real.
You know, I still sometimes question certain things. It's just my nature. I can sometimes be a little more linear. But the test of reason and faith is an ongoing test. But it's very real with me. The fundamentals are there, and there's a confidence about it. There's certain certainty that comes with you. Maybe it's something that happens with age. Maybe it's something that comes with the Spirit. But whatever it is, it's a good feeling.
All right, that's the story from PBS Religion Ethics News Weekly. Hey, put that up again. I wanted to quote from Senator Kerry there. Here's a point where I think, just given what he said, I actually agree. Up, please. There we go. Listen to this. This was actually a statement he made 2 years ago when he was running for president, and he was laying out a moral agenda. that he believes people of all faiths or non-faiths can share. Now, I don't remember commenting on this at the time. Maybe we missed it, but I actually agree with him on this. Listen again, and I'll quote. He says, I lay out these four great challenges, fighting poverty. That's a good thing to do. Poverty hurts people. If you've never experienced it, I haven't, but if you've never experienced it, I imagine you never would. And think, dear friend, whether you are one of those libertarians who says, you know, every man for himself, dog eat dog, who says there should be no welfare state. Just think, my dear friend, how much time you spend every day trying to stay out of poverty. All right? Poverty does matter to you. At least you staying out of poverty matters to you, doesn't it? So let's approach this as people of faith. Helping other people stay out of poverty should matter to us as well. It really should. I don't think that's asking too much of Christians. Okay, fighting poverty. Hey, and by the way, you can't complain. If you're a Republican, you can't complain how the Democrats have failed failed in the war on poverty and the Great Society, and then say, we shouldn't be fighting poverty. You can't blame them for failing to fight it and then refuse to fight it yourself. So there, fighting poverty and disease, taking care of the earth. There's nothing wrong with taking care of the earth. You do it every day. How many of you mow your grass? How many of you fertilize? Some people would say that's harming the earth. How many of you tend your garden? You don't want someone, when someone comes by and dumps their trash in your yard, you happy about it? No, you're not. Okay? So when I was growing up, it was give a hoot, don't pollute. That little owl that flew around telling people not to pollute. At some level, all of us do want to take care of the earth insofar as we can. What's the other thing? He says reducing abortions. I would like to see them reduced to zero. I imagine Senator John Kerry would like to see them reduced less than that. But at least on that one very basic issue, I think we probably agree. And then he says, fighting only just wars. Now, I don't know anybody. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know anybody who would advocate that America go out and fight unjust wars. Hey, let's fight unjust wars. That's a good idea. No. Now, you're right. He's a consummate politician. He's carefully crafted those four items in his moral agenda so that people like me, reasonable people, will look at it and say, hey, I can't argue with that. And I'm just going to be honest with you. I'm not going to argue with any of those points. Those are all good things to do. They really are. If that's all there were to it, and if that was really the common ground that he would like to find morally with Americans, I think I would agree with him wholeheartedly. The problem is, will someone who says this is my moral agenda really consistently try to reduce the number of abortions? Let's just take that for example. Try and reduce the number of abortions. If abortions are a bad thing that we want to reduce, why not try to take them down to zero? I know that's impossible, but it's still worth trying. And it would be all the better if we could agree that we reduce the number of abortions, not just because abortion has turned out to be a really bad thing for our society, but because we sincerely want to protect the unborn, too. Do you remember Senator Kerry making the issue of reducing abortions a major focus of his campaign when he ran for president? Now, they're taking that soundbite from 2004. He said it sometime. I don't remember, and my memory is not the best, but I don't remember him making it a major focus of his presidential campaign. Care to react to anything Senator Kerry had to say on this PBS Religion and Ethics News weekly feature? It's audio open lines 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. The one thing I would fault Kerry for there is this. He spoke of religion and his religious faith in purely private, personal terms, as an inner experience. So the question remains, would that inner experience, such as he has it, have any bearing on his public life? Syl calls from St. Louis. Hi, Syl.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I have a comment regarding in vitro fertilization. Not too long ago, I happened to see a program. It was one of the news magazines doing a piece about sperm donors. And they talked about something that I really never thought about too much. I've not been so thrilled about in vitro fertilization myself. And, you know, the egg's been implanted in another mother, that kind of thing, because I have some reservations about it. But this particular piece really brought it home. This man, who was maybe a college student, had made several donations. And these sperms had been connected with the eggs of a lot of different people. And what is happening is that we have technically half-brothers and sisters around who are now living in the same areas and don't know that they are technically half-brothers and sisters. And they gave the example, one specific example, these two women were in the grocery store, I think, and somehow they talked about the fact that they had, you know, their babies through in vitro fertilization, or the sperm donors, found out that it was the same sperm donor. I can't remember how they found out. They decided to get to know each other and, you know, have like a little club or something. But this is very dangerous, because this means that there will be people meeting each other and don't know that they're half brothers and sisters. And these are things that were not fully thought out, I think. I think somebody told me that, well, it had been planned to not have these sperms connected with eggs in the same area.
Well, let's see if we can deal with it, Syl. Thank you for the call. Okay. Obviously, this is just a scenario that is going to happen sooner or later. Just the laws of probability are going to lead to this. Sooner or later, if you have anonymous donors, and even though the donor remains anonymous, there's always going to be a chance you're going to run into someone who is actually a blood relative. Now, if you think 10, 15, 20 years down the line, will we have to screen for something like this before we allow people to marry and procreate, just to make sure that they're not actually related to one another? Because the normal means of procreation, where you know who the father is, and the father generally, although this is becoming rarer and rarer, fathers children by only one wife. We do now have, as the norm in our society, serial monogamy. I would like to sometimes call it serial polygamy. Because you don't have many wives at once, you just have many wives over the course of time. Sequential polygamy, maybe we might call it. So we have this, men fathering children all over the place. Well, that would be the case in divorce too, wouldn't it, Syl? That would be the case in divorce, where a man fathers children with his wife, they divorce, he goes off, maybe loses contact, fathers more children, maybe he goes through three or four wives, all in the same town. It's theoretically possible that you've got a lot of people there who should not be procreating with one another because they're blood relatives. And maybe the only thing to take away from this, and I don't know the details of the story that you raised, Syl, but the only thing to take away from this is when we deviate from the intended context of procreation, which is a husband who actually knows his wife, and that the father is actually the husband and not just the donor, when we deviate from these things, we only complicate, sometimes with detrimental results, sometimes with no discernible results, we only complicate and mess things up. It's not a more ordered situation, it's a more disorderly situation. You know, I've said it in public on these airwaves, but I've also said it in other contexts, that we need to go back and look at how the church dealt with in vitro fertilization when it was first being examined. I think it's fair to say that the church was either asleep at the switch or dropped the ball, whichever metaphor you prefer. And again, I'll speak here from experience. I had no moral qualms whatsoever about in vitro fertilization when I was a parish pastor. Why? I didn't know what was going on. Two reasons. I didn't know exactly what it was. I assumed it was harmless, with no moral consequences. And number two, because I didn't know what it was, I didn't think it through. I had not informed myself, and then done the necessary critical thinking and moral reasoning that I have at this point because I've been forced to. And I think the church collectively has kind of gone through that. Right now at this late date, we're saying, wait a minute, maybe in vitro fertilization isn't morally neutral, at least not in its process, but in the consequences and the circumstances it inevitably leads to. That's all we're really doing here with embryonic stem cell research when we're talking about an opposition to it. We're saying, look, let's not drop the ball or be asleep at the switch the way we were with in vitro fertilization so that 20 years from now we're saying, golly, we really should have caught that when it first came up. Bill calls from his car. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, a comment on this with your last caller just brought up about one sperm donor being a father of multiple people.
Yes.
When it comes to issues such as inheritance and probate, it's going to be interesting to see this when the lawyers get a hold of this one.
I imagine so, yes. Again, more fuel for the tiny fire I'm building that says when we deviate from God's order of things, the natural, and here I use that term with all the force that it's intended, the natural connection between marriage, procreation, that the father is actually the husband and not merely a donor, that the mother is actually the wife and not merely a donor, as in the case of embryonic stem cell research. When we deviate from that, there are temporal consequences. These things are sins and are certainly have spiritual consequences, but there are temporal consequences likewise. You know, the old commercial for the butter or margarine, whatever it was, she says, it's not nice to fool with Mother Nature. There's no such thing as Mother Nature. We're not violating metaphysical laws built into nature. We're violating the created order. And when we do that, we are not only accountable to God, but there will also be consequences temporally. And there will also be circumstances, sometimes inextricable circumstances, that are created where there's absolutely no right thing to do. You know what one of them is? A frozen embryo in a in vitro fertilization clinic. There's a circumstance where there's only one right thing to do and about a million wrong things to do. And since we generally tend to choose the wrong thing, it only gets worse. Police in India are finding the remains of fetuses outside an abortion clinic. Here's the story. You don't mind, brace yourself for this one. It shows, CNN here shows how the issue of abortion is not just a moral issue here in the U.S. among white-bred Christian right-wingers.
Last month, while helping a police team investigate female feticide in North India, Gulzar Singh had to climb into this tiny well. What he found here and in another adjoining well, he says, will haunt him forever. I found skulls of fetuses, he says, bones from legs and arms. There were also many backbones and bones from tiny feet. And this is the video of it that was broadcast nationwide. Two wells which police say may contain the remains of up to 100 female fetuses. The husband and wife team that ran this clinic have been arrested. Police say he claimed to be a doctor, but was actually a retired soldier with no medical degree. For centuries, Indian society has preferred male children, seeing them as the family's breadwinners. Girls, on the other hand, are widely considered to be liabilities because expensive dowries have to be paid when they're married. It's time such thinking changed, says Pooja Rani, who worked at the clinic and blew the whistle on the scandal. One night, she says, the clinic's owners came to me and asked me to put the body of a six-month-old baby girl into the well, but I refused. The clinic is not an isolated case. We drove 5 hours to a city called Nawashahar, where 1 year ago only 770 females were born for every 1,000 males. It's a prosperous place, actually in a relatively prosperous region of India, where people can afford the ultrasound tests that detect the sex of a fetus, and they're acting on that knowledge. But now many are saying enough's enough. These women work for a local non-governmental organization and have a list of all the pregnant women in this district. Right now, they're going to visit some of them in their homes to counsel them that girls are just as valuable as boys and must be allowed to live. There's a lot of laughter and smiles here at this counseling session. But as this pregnant woman tells me, we know we're being watched. That fear, she says, may help save many baby girls. Women should keep whatever God gives you, she says. It's time for the sinning to stop. More and more people here are thinking this way and have organized huge rallies to condemn feticide. The work is also being done through theater. In this traveling production, which goes village to village, a young girl begs her mother not to abort what could be her baby sister. But perhaps the most effective social deterrent are the mock funerals held outside the homes of families known to have aborted a female fetus. Within a year, because of this vocal campaign, this district's sex ratio has risen dramatically. There are now 900 girls being born instead of 770 for every 1,000 boys. Whistleblower Pooja Rani says it's time for all of India to roll away this evil. As the prosecution's main witness, she says she's been receiving threats, but says that's a small price to end what she calls the silent murder of millions of baby girls. Satinder Bindra, CNN, Patran, North India.
I know, it's the tendency here is to look at something so distant by way of culture and geography and say, look, that's India. Come on. It's overcrowded. It's underdeveloped. And they're obviously so backward. They're using abortion for sex selection, which is what they're doing. I mean, that's what all the statistics are about. And this is, by the way, not poverty-stricken India, but the region they're talking about there is one that's relatively affluent. Where the affluent, relatively speaking, the affluent Indian women and husbands, because I take it here they're complicitous in this, are saying, look, what does their culture say? Their culture and their religion, by and large. Their culture says women are of less value than men. So if you're going to have a limited number of children, it only stands to reason that you do it most efficiently. You want the children who will be of greater value to you. And since women, as pointed out in the story, are considered a financial liability because of, again, culturally, they pay out these large dowries for their daughters to be married, it's only an expense. And the boys have all the earning potential. They can bring home the bacon. Abortion simply becomes another means of sex selection. Before abortion, they might have just left the baby out, exposed to the elements, abandoned the baby off on the side of some road. Guess what? It's the same thing. Now, before you cluck your tongue and say, well, that's just terrible that they're doing using abortion for sex selection. Well, whether you're using it for sex selection or birth control or so that your income or your education won't be hindered, I don't see any difference. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., the Gospel of Judas with Nicholas Perrin of Wheaton College. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening and tune in again tomorrow for 3 hours of Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.